We hope this message from Word of Life Church and Pastor Brian Zahn is a blessing to you.
My sermon today is entitled Game of Thrones. The same as the popular HBO television drama. And though I have never seen this show and have no interest in doing so, I can make a pretty good guess at what that program is like and what it's about. Because you see, the violent lust for thrones of power has been a familiar theme throughout the human story. And it's a story that is told over and over throughout the Bible, this Game of Thrones. So I want to tell you a story this morning about thrones and lust and violence and murder found in the Bible, in 2 Samuel and in 1 Kings. And I'm telling the story just as you find it in the Bible. I have not changed any of the names because none of the players are innocent. The story goes like this. Israel wanted a king. God had chosen the seed of Abraham to be his peculiar people, his own possession. God's intention was that God alone would be their king. But still, they were envious. All the nations of the Gentiles had their kings, and they said, how can we feel like we're a real nation, a real people, if we don't have a king too? And so they bugged God about it until God finally said, fine, you want a king, you can have a king, you're not going to like it. But you can have a king. And so Israel got their first king, King Saul. Saul. Started off with a lot of promise, but then he went all paranoid. He started wiretapping phones and breaking into the Watergate Hotel and just other things, you know, went awry. That part actually isn't. I had actually made that part up. But most of this story is exactly as it's told. And there began to be real problems with paranoid King Saul. Power was corrupting him. And so God made a change mid-course and said, well, you know what? I'm going to reject Saul. I'm going to choose a new king. And he chooses a 15-year-old redheaded boy by the name of David, son of Jesse. Talked about that a couple of weeks ago. And so David at age 15 is anointed king, but he's not going to begin any kind of reign until he's 30. Finally, when David was 30, King Saul was killed in battle on Mount Gilboa in a war with the Philistines. As a result of that, that kind of opened the door, and David became the king, not of all of Israel, but over one tribe, his own tribe, the tribe of Judah. Now, this part's important. You got to learn these names. Abner. Everybody say Abner. Abner was the commander of the armies of the house of Saul. Or you could just say he was Saul's general, Abner. Now, after Saul is killed in battle on Mount Gilboa, Saul's general, Abner, makes one of Saul's sons, Ish-bosheth. Isn't that a cool name? Ish-bosheth. Makes Ish-bosheth the king of, well, Israel. But only over 11 tribes, because one tribe has broken away, the tribe of Judah, and they claim that David is their king. So you see, we're already into a Game of Thrones. Now all of a sudden, the people of God have two thrones. David is king over one tribe, Judah. Ish-bosheth from the house of Saul, king over the remaining 11 tribes. Now David, he has his own general, his own commander of his armies, and his name is Joab, and that's this was David's cousin who was somewhere between one half and three quarters crazy. Joab. But he was good at war, and so he was made David's general. So here we have it now. We're just hardly one generation into the experiment with Israel having a king, and now all of a sudden there's a Game of Thrones going on. We have Ishbosheth from the house of Saul with 11 tribes, and Abner is his commander of his armies. And then we have David over the one tribe of Judah, and the commander of his armies is his half-crazy cousin, Joab. Now one day, Abner and Joab and their respective armies faced off at the pool of Gibeon. And while they're just sitting there, one on one side, the other on the opposite, glaring at one another, Abner said, "Okay, let's break the tension here. Let's have a contest. We'll pick our 12 best fighters. You pick your 12 best fighters, and they'll come out in the middle and they'll, you know, a little sport, a little mortal combat, a little battle to the death to while away the time." And somehow this seemed like a good idea to everybody. And so each side selects 12. Of course, 12 is significant. This is the number of tribes that Israel is supposed to be. So they're both making their claim that we are the true 12. No, we're the true 12. And 24 men come out and they're going to simultaneously fight one another. Are you with me? Those with Abner and those with Joab. And they come out and they pair up. And in one moment, as soon as somebody says, "Go," "Let the fight begin," ding, round one. Each one, 12 on 12, 24 men, each one grabs the other by the hair and takes their sword and thrusts it through the other one, and all 24 simultaneously fall dead. It's a lovely story. And it's kind of a little prophetic symbol here that, well, this is what it might end up. You might just all kill yourself. Later on, Jesus will say, "All who take to the sword will perish by the sword." But this is kind of an illustrated version of it. Well, after that happened, then just a general battle broke out. And in the course of this battle, Abner, commander of the forces of the house of Saul under King Ishbosheth, kills the brother of Joab, commander of David's armies. And so now Joab has some kind of reason to have deep animosity toward Abner, because in battle, Abner had killed Joab's brother. By the way, the Bible does go into detail about how, well, you see, what happened was this brother of Joab was chasing Abner, and Abner said, "Look, I don't want to kill you. I don't want to kill you. Go away, go away. Fight somebody else. You don't want to mess with me. You don't want to mess with me." And the guy said, "No, I want to mess with you." And then Abner just ran him through with his spear, the blunt end of his spear, and went through his stomach and came out his back. This is in the Bible. And so now, you know, there's more bloodshed. And the war was on between these two competing factions in their Game of Thrones. Who was the real king of the people of God? Is it Ishbosheth or is it David? And the war is dragging on. And during this period of time, Abner, commander of the forces of the house of Saul under King Ishbosheth, starts sleeping with one of the girls from old dead King Saul's harem, a girl named Rizpah. And yes, they had harems. Yes, they had a harem. Saul had a harem. David had a harem. He had 12 girls in his harem. Solomon, when he becomes king, he's going to have a harem deluxe. 300 concubines to go along with his 700 wives. So much can be said, but I think I'll leave that alone. Now, Ishbosheth, who's 40 years old at this time, who's been made king by the general, Abner, he's not cool with this. He assumes that he has inherited his father's harem, and now his general is sleeping with one of the concubines from the harem, and he's like, "Whoa, you treaded upon my territory here. You're encroaching upon my privilege." And so King Ishbosheth confronts General Abner over his sleeping with one of the concubines from the harem, and the deal goes down like this. 2 Samuel 3, verse 6 and following. As the war between the house of Saul and the house of David went on, Abner became a powerful leader among those loyal to Saul. One day, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, accused Abner of sleeping with one of his father's concubines, a woman named Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, just like I told you. Abner was furious. "Am I some Judean dog to be kicked around like this?" he shouted. "After all I've done for your father, Saul, and his family and friends by not handing you over to David, is this my reward, that you find fault with me about this woman? May God strike me and even kill me if I don't do everything I can to help David get what the Lord has promised to him. I'm going to take Saul's kingdom and give it to David. I will establish the throne of David over Israel as well as Judah, all the way from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south." Ishbosheth didn't say another word because he was afraid of what Abner might do. And well, he should be afraid of Abner. So Abner is upset with Ishbosheth because of this deal with this concubine. And so he says, well, I'm just going to... He decides he's going to defect to David and take the army with him. And so he sends a messenger to King David saying something to the effect, I think we should get together and talk. I might be interested in switching sides here. Could we arrange a meeting? David sends a message back and says, look, this is great. I'm all for it, but I got one condition. You have to bring me back my first wife. Now, he's got six or seven wives at this point, David does. I lost track. But his first wife was the daughter of Saul, Michal. And in the split of the kingdom, she ends up with the house of Saul. And David says, you got to bring her back to me because, and I quote, I purchased her from Saul at the price of 100 Philistine foreskins. You cannot make this stuff up. And Abner says, yeah, I can arrange that. I'll bring her back. And so Abner comes with his top 20 captains and meets with David kind of secretly. And they come to an agreement that Abner is going to defect, take the army, and try to unify Israel. After they reach an agreement, David throws a big feast for Abner and his 20 commanders. And they have a nice time and all of that. And then Abner says, well, I got to go now. I'm going to go back and I'm going to arrange all this. And I'll bring the army of the house of Saul over to your side and we'll pull this thing together. And then Joab hears about it. Remember, Joab is David's secretary of defense. He hears about this, and he's furious. In fact, he's furious is what he is. He already has a deep grudge against Abner for killing his brother, but now, you know, this is a threat to his power and position, and he's furious that this has happened. So he sends a message to Joab, a ruse, and he says to Abner. Who's on his way back home. He says, no, you got to come back. We got to work out some details. So Abner turns around and he comes back. And Joab is standing right there at the gate there at Hebron to meet him. Oh, hello. Abner, it's wonderful to see you, you know. I know we had that little tiff there at the pool of Gibeon, but, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. And we got to work some things out if we're going to work together. And so, here, step aside. Come here. Right, we need to have, I would like to talk to you in private. And he takes him into a secluded spot, pulls out his knife, thrusts it through his stomach, and Abner falls over dead. David is upset about this, but what can he do? Now things are beginning to fall apart for Ishbosheth. His commander has been killed, apparently in the midst of trying to defect. And everybody's kind of reading the writing on the wall, and people are beginning to say, I don't know, is Ishbosheth going to keep this together or not? And then he had two captains in his army. Their names are Rechab and Baanah. I knew you wanted to know that, so I thought I would tell you. Rechab and Baanah. They began a plot, and they said, well, we're going to assassinate Ishbosheth. And so they came to the palace of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day at the time when the king was taking his nap, because they hadn't invented air conditioning yet and it was too hot to do anything other than take a nap. And they come to the palace and they tell people, you know, the guards, they say, well, we're here to get some wheat. That was the kind of deceit they played. Well, we need to get some wheat. That's what it says. I don't know. And then they made their way to the king's royal bedchamber. And there was a maid that would sit outside. This is all in the Bible. The maid would sit outside to notify the king if anybody came, but she had fallen asleep too. And so they were able to sneak past the maid into the bedroom of the king, Ishbosheth, these two captains in the army, and they pulled out their daggers and stabbed Ishbosheth to death in his sleep. And then they cut off his head. Lovely story too. They cut off his head, put it in a bag. Oh, we got the wheat! And they were able to get out of the palace undetected. And they took the head of Ishbosheth to King David, seeking to ingratiate themselves. They said, look, here is your rival. We cut off his head, and I thought you'd be real happy, so here it is. This was a mistake on their part. David was not at all happy. In fact, he was deeply offended that they had done this, and so he ordered them to be executed. And they were executed, and then David ordered that their hands and their feet be cut off and that their corpses be hung at the pool of Hebron. Wasn't that pretty? These two handless and footless corpses hanging up there as a sign, woe betide those that cut off the heads of their enemies. I wonder where they learned that, though. Never mind. And thus David becomes king over all of Israel. That's how it went down. That's the story. Now David is king over all of Israel, because his rival Ishbosheth has been put to death. And David reigns over all of Israel for 33 years as king. 7 years over just Judah, and then an additional 33 years over all of Israel. And now David is 70 years old, and he's lying on his deathbed. The matter of succession comes up. Who's going to be the next king? You say, well, David's son. Well, David's got lots of sons. He's got 6 or 7 wives. He's got lots of sons. But Bathsheba, you remember her, she is able to elicit from David a promise that her son, Solomon, will be the next king. And so Solomon is brought to the bedside of his dying father. And David begins to dispense some wisdom from his deathbed to his soon-to-be successor son, Solomon. And among other things that David says to Solomon, he brings up Joab, his half-crazy cousin, who's an old man now, who had led his army, had been his, you know, secretary of defense all these years. And this is what David says. You're a wise man, Solomon. You'll know what to do with Joab, but don't let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. It's kind of a euphemistic language. But Solomon was clever, if nothing else, and he got the drift. You're going to have to get rid of Joab. And so, finally, David dies. Succession is made to Solomon. Solomon is crowned now the third king. And among the first things he does is he sends an executioner to dispatch Joab. Joab hears about it, though, and he rushes to the tabernacle of Yahweh, where there's the Ark of the Covenant and the altar, and the table of the showbread and the incense, the tabernacle. This is before the temple's built. The tabernacle. And Joab, an old man now, runs into the tabernacle and lays hold of the horns of the altar. It's an appeal to God. It's someone saying, I throw myself upon God's mercy. The executioner sees this and says, And he goes back and he says, well, Joab caught wind of what I was about to do, and he ran into the tabernacle, laid a hold of the horns of the altar. What am I going to do now? Solomon says, go in the tabernacle and kill him right there. So the executioner goes back. He says, come on, Joab, come on. Just come on out. You know how this deal's going to go down. It's like a gangster movie thing. Come on now, just come on. Take it like a man. Come on out. Joab says, no, I'm standing here clinging to the horns of the altar of God. If you're going to kill me, you come in here and kill me. So the executioner went in there and put Joab to death as he clung to the horns of the altar seeking mercy. Shortly after that, Solomon found an excuse to murder his brother Adonijah so that he wouldn't have any rival for the throne. And 1 Kings chapter 2 ends with this terse comment. So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. He had won the Game of Thrones. And Israel has its third king. But all the while, it's been a Game of Thrones. Now, for those of you that are keeping score at home, in our little story of the first three kings of Israel, there have been 31 killings, murders, and executions. And it doesn't get any better. If anything, it gets worse as we move on to Jeroboam and Rehoboam and all of that. This is pretty much the story of the kings of Israel. It's a Game of Thrones filled with murder, intrigue, plot, lust, deceit. I don't know about you, but I could use some New Testament about now. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling like I need a little New Testament. Perry says, preach it. That's saying, sick him to a bulldog. Gospel of Mark, that's in the New Testament. Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, beginning with verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over to him and spoke to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do us a favor. Sorry, these two brothers that are disciples of Jesus, James and John, sons of Zebedee, they come to Jesus and they ask for a favor. Jesus says, what is your request? Verse 37, they replied, when you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in places of honor next to you. One on your right and the other on your left. We got another Game of Thrones going on here. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I'm about to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering I'm about to be baptized with? Oh, yes, they replied. We are able. Then Jesus told them, you will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering, but I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen. Do you see what's going on? Interestingly, Luke sets this scene in the upper room during the Last Supper. James and John, two brothers, sons of Zebedee, they believe, like everybody else, that Jesus is about to become the king. He's going to overthrow Herod, kind of like David overthrew Ish-bosheth, something like that. It'll happen something like that. And Jesus is going to become the latest king. Now, because they believe Jesus is, you know, something special, he's going to be better. But they really, fundamentally, they don't think it's going to be much different. He's just going to be a new and improved version of what has always been. And so they start maneuvering for proximity to the throne of power because that's how they understand it. And they say, hey, Jesus, we want you to do us a favor. You know, I know you love us, so would you do us a favor? Jesus says, well, what's the favor? Well, when you sit on your glorious throne, you know, the throne of David, when you sit on your glorious throne, can we be on your right and left? Can we be Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense? And Jesus said, oh, you don't know what you're asking. You have no idea what you're asking. Are you able to drink my cup of suffering, be baptized in bitter suffering? Are you able to? Oh, yeah, we're able. Jesus said, well, come to think of it, you probably will suffer. But to be on my right and my left as I come to my glorious throne, that is not mine to give. It's for whomever God has prepared it. Come on, church, come on. Don't you understand? Don't you know that the glorious throne of Jesus is his cross? The glorious throne of Jesus is his cross. It's not a throne of power like Saul and David and Solomon and Rehoboam and Jeroboam and all the rest. It's a cross. And that's why Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking. You think you're asking to be my Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. You're asking to be crucified with me. That I can't grant. It's for whoever it's prepared. It turned out to be two thieves that were in near proximity to his glorious throne. I continue to read, picking up the story now in verse 41. When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. Mimetic rivalry breaking out all over now. So Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. All right, so when the other 10 disciples hear about the request of James and John, they're indignant, they're upset, they're angry, they're envious. And now all 12 have been sucked into the Game of Thrones. I mean, it threatens to be just a continuation of that long litany that I gave you. And if you doubt, you can go home today and you can read 2 Samuel chapters 2, 3, and 4, and then the epilogue, 1 Kings chapter 2. And that's just the way it went down. And that's just for the first three kings. Plotting, scheming, maneuvering, murdering. And this virus that we can call for this sermon, the Game of Thrones, had infected even the 12. And Jesus sets them down in the upper room at the table. And he said, guys, you know how it is among all of these kings. And how it's all about getting power and holding on to power. It shall not be so with you. It's going to be different. He doesn't say this, but Jesus, I think, is thinking, you don't understand now. You will. Because you're going to come to realize that my coronation is going to be by crucifixion. And my glorious throne is going to be my cross. And you're going to understand that I didn't come to take lives, but to give my life. So Jesus sits with the 12. And he tells them, no more. No more throne games. With you, it's going to be different. And then Jesus will leave the upper room and go to his coronation by crucifixion. And Jesus wins his kingdom, not by killing, but by giving his life to ransom us from sinful throne games. Ah, and this is why I love Jesus. Because he changed the whole game. It's not about power. It's about love. Jesus is not only enthroned and coronated at the cross, he refounds the world. The world is given a new order. Instead of being organized around an axis of power, that's what the Game of Thrones is all about. Instead of being organized around an axis of power enforced by violence. Again, I've never seen that HBO show. I'm not interested in it because I know what it's about. I know what it's about. I can read that stuff in the Bible. The Old Testament. Jesus refounds the world if we can accept it. At the cross, he is coronated by crucifixion. Refounds the world from an axis of power enforced by violence to an axis of love expressed in forgiveness. He gives his life to ransom us from our sinful throne games. And it's at the communion table that we learn to stop playing throne games and receive the kingdom as a gift. Just receive the kingdom as a gift. Remember when Jesus says, "Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." You don't have to plot. You don't have to maneuver. You don't have to be envious. You don't have to be looking out of the corner of your eyes and seeing who's coming up beside you. You can trust God to give you your portion. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And so today we come to the table of the Lord to worship. We come to remember Jesus Christ, to proclaim his death until he comes. We come to this table on this day as a place where we can end our Game of Thrones. I don't think any of you are involved in some sort of, you know, high-level political intrigue that involves murder plots and assassinations. Except at work, where it's maneuvering, a little bit of character assassination, just a word dropped, you know, at the right moment to maybe alter the way the boss thinks about that coworker. Well, we play it in our own way. But what does Jesus say to us? And he says it in love. Jesus says, "But among you, it will be different." And so we come to receive forgiveness for how we've played. How many will be here honest? How many of you are honest enough to say, yeah, at some point in my life, I've played some throne games? Sure. But we come here to receive our Lord's forgiveness and pardon and to make a fresh commitment to say, no, we're going to follow Jesus. We're not following Saul or David or Solomon or Jeroboam or Ishbosheth or Rehoboam. We're following Jesus. And he says that among us, among his disciples, it's going to be different. And so our prayer is that it really could be different. Now stand with me. And Lord Jesus, we pray that you would help us to be your different people, your peculiar people. Your people over whom you reign as the king, but you're a king unlike any we've ever known. You're a king that washes our feet. You're a king that does not take the life of your enemies, but you lay down your life. You are a king whose glorious throne is in the form of crucifixion. And you say to us, at the institution of this sacred meal that we come to even now, you say to us that it's to be different among us. That we're not to follow the way of the world. We're not to play the game of thrones. And so we come to this table to receive your pardon, to receive your mercy, to receive your forgiveness, and to receive your life that we might go forth and that we might be your flesh and blood presence in the world. Join with me, church, and pray in our prayer of confession. Most merciful God.